You are listening to a sermon by Carl Brown, recorded on Sunday, August 29th, 2010, at the Point Grey Interminonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Well, my name is Carl Brown, for those of you who have never seen me before. And since the first Sunday of this month, August the 1st, we've been listening to sermons on the book of Job. And today we conclude the series. And it was pointed out that, yes, I get the happy ending part to speak on, but the price to pay is that I've got to come up with a conclusion. Okay, this is the last speech that we have on Job, and this is the fifth one. So our story so far, there's this guy named Job. He's well off, he has money, wealth, family, and some spirit or celestial being, Satan, who has the ear of God, wants to test Job's faithfulness to God. God lets him. Job suffers. His friends come to cheer him up, but they just end up arguing with him, testing Job's faith even further. The very picturesque, flowery, passionate, and long arguments that his friends give him pivot on one rule: God punishes the bad and rewards the good. And here I'd like to quote one of my favorite statements by Job, chapter 16, verse 2. Miserable comforters are you all. It's true. And today, starting at chapter 38, we get God coming to Job's tent and clearing everything up by saying, "Hey, I made you like a potter makes a pot. I'll do whatever I want with you. I don't need to give you a reason. And your friends here, I'm going to turn them into dust unless you ask me not to. Oh, and here's all your health and wealth back. Goodbye." And he leaves. That's how God clears things up. All right. The friends who came to cheer Job up keep churning out words that say the same thing. You done wrong, Job. It's the only possible explanation. No character in the book seems to possess any imagination regarding God and his plan, which is perhaps the only way the characters can act if the story is to say what it does. It would destroy this story to have the character say, "Perhaps Job has these troubles, so that God can create a story which will be read and help thousands of people, millions of people over thousands of years. Yeah, maybe that's what's going on, Job." Well, none of the characters seem to have that kind of imagination. They're all very one-dimensional. You're done wrong, admit it. Come on. The concept that God's ways might be mysterious, perhaps even beyond our understanding, does not exist in any of the speeches by either Job, his wife, or friends. This is left to be stated by God in chapter 38. Now, there are two ways to read the text of God's response starting in chapter 38. One is sarcastically, and it looks that way, telling Job, "You're just dust." And another way is rhetorically, sort of a, "Here, let me help you understand." And you have to be careful with the wording, because when you read it, it looks very sarcastic. However, it may indicate more love and acceptance than sarcasm, the sarcasm you might read into it. And let me illustrate by telling you about a friend of mine who's Jewish, and his father was Jewish, and his father was very Jewish. They grew up in New York, and his father went to the synagogue weekly, daily when he could. And he told me how his father used to pray. his Jewish father would be walking around in the kitchen, and he'd be like this, and he'd finally get ready to pray, and he'd start his prayers by saying, God, I know you're listening. And we don't exactly pray that way, do we? It's very familial. It's very kind of sarcastic, we might say. You know, that's not respecting God. But in a way, that way, you know, it might be. It might be saying, you know, I'm so close to you that I can talk this way to you. And that might be what's happening here. Now, what I'm going to do, I won't read the entire five chapters. And in fact, I'm just going to paraphrase the highlights. I'm going to read a few statements sarcastically, because that's the way it's written. So starting at 38, and I'm paraphrasing and just hitting occasional things, so don't bother reading along in your text, because it won't work. But then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind. Who is speaking all these foolish words? Stand up. Listen to me. I've got a few questions to ask you. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Who determined the measurements? Any idea? Who laid its cornerstone? And that's the way it kind of looks. Let me continue in a more rhetorical way. Job. Who made the oceans? And who said, the water stops here and the land starts here? Have you commanded the morning sun to rise? Have you walked on the bottom of the ocean? God's kind of helping Job along. Did you create every drop of dew this morning? Can you put the stars in their place? Can you take them down? Can you call to the clouds and make them rain when it's needed? Can you feed the animals, all the animals on the earth? Are you so clever that you can make birds and teach them how to migrate? So talk to me, Job. Tell me what you can do. Then Job answered the Lord, Lord, I am nothing. I regret everything I said about you. The Lord says, can you tame a whale? I'm the Lord. I could make a dragon if I wanted to. Then Job answered the Lord, I know that you can do all things, whatever you please to do. I knew you existed, but now that I see you with my own eyes, I am disgusted by my words. I repent in sackcloth and ashes. And I'm just going to end the story here, the book of Job, with no paraphrases, just the last chapter. Or just the last bit of the last chapter. And the Lord restored the fortunes of Job when he had prayed for his friends. And the Lord gave Job twice as much as he had before. Then there came to him all his brothers and sisters and all who had known him before. And they ate bread with him at his house. They showed him sympathy and comforted him for the evil that the Lord had brought upon him. And each of them gave him a piece of money and a gold ring. The Lord blessed the latter days of Job more than his beginning, and he had 14,000 sheep, 6,000 camels, 1,000 yoke of oxen, and 1,000 donkeys. He also had 7 sons and 3 daughters. He named the first Jemimiah, the second Kiza, and the third Karen Halach. In all the land there were no women so beautiful as Job's daughters, and their father gave them an inheritance along with their brother. After this, Job lived for 140 years and saw his children and his children's children 4 generations. And Job died old and full of days. So this completes our 5-week chapters of the books. But what's the meaning? Why did God give us this story? What are we supposed to learn from it? And if you look at the storyline, Job is good. Job is tested. Job stays good. Job is rewarded. Story ends. That's what you get for a story. Okay, well, what was the point of writing the story? Well, there's lots of ways of looking at the book of Job, and I'm going to just look at 5. So to find a point, let's look at it firstly as poetry. The book has a lot of great poetry. God's splendor is pointed out at great length by every character, except Job's wife, but she doesn't get much ink. Much of the text is about God's majesty and uses majestic imagery. And Evan put it well last week when he said, like a symphony, Job is better enjoyed by hearing it rather than talking about it. It's delightful poetry. I couldn't get his permission earlier, so I'll ask his forgiveness later. Okay, so one, as poetry. Two, as a story. We could look at Job just as a story. Okay, looking at the storyline itself, we look at this book presenting our mysterious, miserable little lives. We're on this earth, and the storyline represents our suffering. It's a story about suffering. Okay, so as poetry, as a story. And this is kind of interesting. With a bit of a viewpoint shift, we can look at it as a courtroom trial. There's a fellow, Robert Sutherland is his name. He wrote a book. Robert Sutherland is a criminal defense lawyer. He lives in Canada. And he wrote a book, Putting God on Trial, the Biblical Book of Job. In this book, Robert Sutherland tells the story of Job as if the whole book of Job was a courtroom trial. And he's the courtroom reporter. He's expressing it in legal language from legal points of view. And it's a trial not about Job. It's a trial about God being held account for all the evil on the earth. Now, it matters not that evil may happen through random chance or through an agent, you might call him Satan. The fact that God is all-powerful and therefore able to prevent such evil places his majesty in a culpable position. Because God could have prevented the evil, but he didn't, he must be considered the perpetrator of said evil. And he must be brought to justice. Sounds like the mind of a lawyer to me. A quote from Mr. Sutherland's book. The gratuitous evil God sends is more punishment than any man deserves. And the gratuitous evil God sends destroys character more often than not. Human beings have a moral duty to challenge God for such evil. Surprisingly, Mr. Sutherland is not Jewish. I would have thought he was. Okay, so you could look at it as a courtroom trial. It's a very interesting book to read. Number four, another way to look at it, we can look at the book of Job as proof of God's existence. Now that's quite something. Try to prove that God exists. Well, what is proof? Proof is establishment of a matter by lawful means and argument. In other words, you have to select a set of laws, and using those laws, you prove something. This is much more difficult now than it was in times past, when the only tools required for such proof was reason and common sense. You might have noted that Job's friends drew heavily on these two proofs. Now, in our age, everyone in their childhood years is taught the scientific method. Modern thought, therefore, does not give common sense much credibility. Following the scientific method, we expect proof to be backed up by hard data and consistently reproducible results. That's what we call proof. Now, having said that, there's a strong modern school of thought stating that there are proofs for the existence of God. These proofs present a large probability of his existence, but not an absolute certainty. And the name of this school of thought is intelligent design, ID, it's called. And to explain the whole basis of ID, intelligent design, there's a charming story. It's told about Isaac Newton He had an orrery built for him by a craftsman. Anybody know what an orrery is? Well, when I was a boy, just after the dinosaurs died, at the school I was at, we had an orrery. It was amazing for a kid because it had in the center of this thing, it had on a little pedestal, it had a golden ball, and then extending from that pedestal, there was little wires, and there was little balls on the wires, and when you turned a crank, the ball in the center stayed still, but all the other balls went around it. And it represented the sun and the planets. And it was just fantastic, because when you turned it, not only did Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars go around the sun, they went around the sun exactly as they would in real life. That is to say, Venus went around 1.5 times for every time that Earth went around once. And the Earth had a little moon, and the little moon went around exactly as it should. It was just amazing. And so the story is that Isaac Newton had one of these built. And he had a friend who was an atheist. And they'd argue about whether God exists or not. And one day his atheist friend comes and visits, and he sees the orrery. He says, "That's fantastic. This is great. It's beautiful. I love the way that... Who made this?" And Sir Isaac Newton says, "Nobody." His friend says, "Did you hear me? I asked who made it." And Isaac Newton said, "No one. It just kind of happened." The guy says, "That's preposterous. Somebody had to make it." And Sir Isaac Newton says, No. Just, you know, little bits of junk and dust kind of accreted in the corner there. And, you know, things happened. It rusted. And then one morning I came in, there it was. And his friend says, "I'm not crazy. What are you telling me this story for?" Sir Isaac Newton, of course, says, "Well, you know, you're amazed by this little model, which is just a puny image of the real thing. And yet you're telling me it's preposterous that it just happened? When every day you try to tell me that the real thing, the whole Earth, the solar system, the sun, the universe, just happened? There was no creator?" And that is the basis of the school of thought called ID, intelligent design. One of the curious things about intelligent design is it never mentions who the creator might be, who the designer, the engineer might be. The school of intelligent design tries to isolate itself from religious issues. So they're actually trying to prove that there was a designer to the earth, but they're not willing to call it God. Okay, Darwin seems to have given this school its start. It's worth noting here, though, that while he was convinced that the world didn't just happen, that there really was a creator, Darwin fell into the trap created by the problem of evil, which we'll get to in a moment. In Darwin's own words from a letter to Asa Gray, "I cannot persuade myself that a beneficent and omnipotent God would have designedly created the parasitic wasp, or that a cat should torture mice." And just to give Darwin his due, as a man who thought heavily about and could not really deny the Creator, from that same letter he says, "I feel most deeply that the whole subject is too profound for the human intellect. A dog might as well speculate on the mind of Newton." Okay, the fifth one, the last one. How else can we look at the book of Job? You could look at it as an early form of theodicy. Theodicy was touched on during our introduction to the series on August the 1st, and it's a science. If you're Roman Catholic, it's a science anyways. Theodicy is the science of justifying the existence of a good and powerful God in a world that is filled with pain and evil. That's the problem of evil. Andre mentioned it earlier on. So a bit of background for the problem of evil. God is accepted as having these three traits: omnipotence, omniscience, and omnibenevolence. Now, in one being, that's a big problem, because, of course, omnipotence would mean that God can cure any evil. Omniscience would mean that God can see everything, every evil, everywhere, anytime. And omnibenevolence means that God is perfectly good, the antithesis of evil. And so, you take those three traits and you make a classic argument. The classic argument just has three points. Number one, if an all-powerful and perfectly good God exists, then evil does not. Two, there is evil in the world. And three, therefore, an all-powerful and perfectly good God does not exist. Ta-da, done. We just got rid of God. So that is the problem of evil, the classic textbook problem of evil. Evil on the earth seems to disprove God's existence. How can an all-powerful, all-knowing, all-loving God allow evil on the earth? It's illogical. Therefore, God does not exist. Okay, so let's get back to Job. But now, how does God explain himself for the evil that happened to Job? It's pretty simple. He doesn't. He just says, and he walks in chapter 38 and says, I am so fantastic that even four chapters can't quite cover it. Now, of course, that's funny because I'm saying it, but poor Job, he's sitting there and God walks in. Just that very fact would reduce anybody to quaking. God says, you can't imagine how fantastic I am. You just don't have the mind for it. And that's his explanation. Thank you very much. Goodbye. So, perhaps that previous three-point argument, which proves that God does not exist, does not quite sew things up. And it doesn't. Because of so many reasons, but one I'd like to focus on, an aspect of God which is ignored in that argument, is free will. Now, if you think about that, what has free will got to do with the problem of evil? Okay, well, consider this. If the human experience was one of total certainty like Job's friends were all about, right? God punishes evil, God rewards good, that's it, total certainty. Okay, if human experience was one of total certainty with daily proof that God rewarded good and punished evil, we would have no free will. Now, unlike a three-year-old who could perform sneaky acts of mischief, undetectable by parents who would punish him, humans would not be able to escape God's punishment even if they only thought of doing wrong. Because God knows all, he would detect any evil, every little wrong we did. And if he really did punish us immediately and consistently for those wrongs, we would become simple, timid little pets. You wouldn't do anything wrong. God would know about it right now and bam! You just have a conditioned reflex as soon as you could walk. You'd be God's little pet. In light of that reasoning, it just beggars the imagination to truly believe that God would punish us in this life for our wrongs. In the same vein of thought, if God rewarded us immediately and consistently for each good act, humans would never be able to make those little or big acts of sacrifice. Those acts of sacrifice that we make develop our humanity. They create our character. They make us who we are. If we were rewarded for every good that we did, then by definition there would be no sacrifices. There would only be rewards. Okay. Well, that's the end of my theodicy rant. So that's the five ways I've got for looking at Job today. We now return back to the book of Job with the realization that there are a number of ways to look at the book. So closing this book after spending five Sundays on it is not to be taken lightly. I understand that. After all, professionals make a career out of the Book of Job. But what kind of conclusion can we find? Is it a beautiful poem? Is it a simple story? Is it a courtroom trial? Is the Book of Job proof of God's existence? Is the book a theodicy? Or is Job a case for intelligent design? I believe that the answer is yes to all of the above. None of them contradict the other. The poetry and the story both read well, and it has a happy ending. It is a trial, not only of Job, but of God as well. And the trial gives us an insight to the problem of evil as well. God's words in the last chapters tell us to look towards reason, probability, and old-fashioned engineering to find proof of his existence and to strengthen our faith in him. I am fond of this book. I've been fond of this book for most of my life. I'm fond of it for its poetry, for the story, and the sense of proportion that it gives me regarding the glory of God. Also, I find the book rich enough to stand the test of time. The intelligent design school was thousands of years in the future when Job was written, yet it speaks very clearly to that school. But to close, I have a simple statement. I believe that the point of the Book of Job is to make our weak faith in God stronger. As a story, a poem, a trial, a proof, and a theodicy, Job is a multi-purpose book which smooths out my Christian journey through this life. The book gives me the foundation to say that I am firmly with the intelligent design theorists. There is a creator, with the exception that I don't mind naming the designer. He is my God.